Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
One of the ways to figure out what's going on with the economy, of course, is by reading between the lines of corporate profit reports. But sometimes those same documents explain human behavior pretty well, too. MasterCard and Visa reported earnings this morning, and it looks like consumers are wising up about credit. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here today, everybody. It's Thursday, the last day of July. And that means a lot of us are going to be getting our bank and credit card statements in the mail pretty soon. Both Visa and MasterCard made plenty of money off of us pulling the plastic out of our wallets. But both companies also said they saw signs of slowing growth in credit card use. Our New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott reports.
At the Amish market in Manhattan today, Thomas Milson paid for his sandwich and soda with plastic, but not the kind that can lead to piles of debt.
I paid with a debit card. I usually try and stay within my means.
Signs are more people are thinking like Milson these days. James Van Dyke is president of Javelin Strategy and Research. He says 37% of people his firm surveyed have cut back on their credit card spending. He chalked it up to concerns about the economy.
They're holding off on credit cards. They're being cautious about building up a big balance that they might have trouble paying off later. And they're not buying some things that maybe are really discretionary spend items.
Others say consumers have no choice but to lay off the charge cards. People hurt by job cuts or the housing downturn may have maxed out. Banks facing their own credit woes have reduced credit limits, raised interest rates, and made it harder to get new cards. Have you noticed you're not getting as many offers in the mail? Moshe Katri follows the credit card business for Cowen Equity Research. He says MasterCard and Visa are still making money on growth overseas and on debit cards. They're linked to checking accounts.
The major driver here is the ongoing shift away from, cash and checks to cards. In our view, if people continue to use cards, even in a tough environment.
Visa and MasterCard make less money on each debit card swipe than on credit card transactions, but both companies say debit card spending is growing at least twice as fast. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The gross domestic product news this morning. The GDP was up 1.9% in the second quarter. Really turns out to be a dollar story instead. Rising exports thanks to a weak greenback are what fueled economic growth April through June. Going back in time just a bit, there was a hidden lump of coal in today's report. The Commerce Department says during the last quarter of last year, the economy actually did shrink. Not much, just 0.2%, but still. Marlboro, meet Benson and Hedges. Philip Morris International announced today that it's buying Rothmans, the Canadian cigarette maker, for about $2 billion. That'll give the company about a third of the Canadian tobacco market. The U.S. market, meanwhile, could be in for some changes. The House of Representatives has passed a bill that would let the Food and Drug Administration regulate tobacco for the first time. It's not a done deal yet, still has to pass the Senate. But some in the industry say it actually stacks the deck in favor of Philip Morris USA. That's this country's biggest tobacco company. From Washington Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
If you have a fondness for flavored cigarettes, yesterday's vote on the tobacco bill was bad news.
It bans closed cigarettes because closed cigarettes appeal to young people. It bans other flavorings because they appeal to young people.
Matthew Myers heads the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. He says flavors are one way tobacco companies lure new smokers. Every day, more than 1,000 kids pick up the habit, and each year, roughly 400,000 Americans die. The bill gives the FDA authority to see secret recipes and demand changes, like cutting nicotine and banning menthol. Myers says the goal is to make it harder to get hooked, easier to quit, and maybe even lead to a less dangerous cigarette, though no one knows if that's possible. R.J. Reynolds lobbied against the bill. Some of its most popular brands are menthols and lights. Steve Kotak, a Reynolds executive, says informed adults should be allowed to make their own decisions.
We believe there's a need for public health policies that are broader than the abstinence-only, one-size-fits-all approach embodied in this bill.
But Meyer says he had one surprising ally, Philip Morris, which is betting
that in that highly regulated market, it will gain a competitive advantage. What we care about is that we believe the legislation will save lives.
Competitors feel the bill's advertising ban means Philip Morris will simply lock in its market dominance. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
From one thing in the air that's bad for you to another, now, when it comes to producing greenhouse gases, airplanes and ships are pretty much in a class by themselves. So today, five states and a coalition of environmental groups said they're going to sue the Environmental Protection Agency to force it to do something about that. Marketplace's Renita Jablonski has more.
The states say they've been waiting for the EPA to get back to them since last year. That's when petitions started going out asking the agency to regulate greenhouse gas emissions as a pollutant under the Clean Air Act. Instead, on July 11th, the EPA responded by saying it would only take public comment on the issue. Jake Weigler is a spokesman for the Oregon Attorney General's office.
We've asked the EPA for quite a while now to look into regulating this area, an area that we feel needs to be covered by climate change solutions, and the EPA has failed to respond.
Oregon, California, Connecticut, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and New York City want the EPA to require airlines to use cleaner fuels and design more efficient airplanes. The same idea would apply to off-road vehicles. A solution for ships includes just slowing them down. Sarah Burt, a lawyer at Earth Justice, says this isn't just about regulating airplanes and cruise ships.
The first step is for EPA to make its formal endangerment finding to actually conclude that greenhouse gases do have the potential to cause harm to human health.
The EPA's Jonathan Schrader says making that kind of conclusion official would mean regulating every part of the economy.
I think these states, their time would be better served lobbying their delegations in Congress to take action rather than spending taxpayers' dollars in court.
By the time a lawsuit would be filed, a new, more regulation-friendly administration could be in place. I'm Renita Jablonski for Marketplace.
That thud you heard coming from the corner of Wall Street and Broad right about the time the closing bell rang today, that was traders giving up on an already down day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Think about this fact for a second as you consider the high price of fossil fuels. Enough sunlight hits this planet every hour to meet its energy needs for an entire year. Energy crisis solved, right? Not to mention global warming, too. Except it's not that easy. The thing about solar is that it's inefficient and expensive to store that kind of power when the sun's not shining. Today, a researcher at MIT said he's found a way around the darkness, and that has entrepreneurs knocking on his door, as Marketplace's Dan Gretsch explains.
MIT professor Daniel Nocera has discovered an inexpensive way of using the sun's energy to split water into hydrogen and oxygen gases. After the sun goes down, the gases can be recombined to create electricity. The process is called electrolysis. Nocera says until now, electrolysis required expensive transformer boxes.
This looks like the real thing. It's as cheap as you can get. It's easy to manufacture. And unlike those big transformer boxes, this works in a glass of water.
MIT has patented the process and is forming a company to develop the technology for market. Nocera also published his discovery in today's issue of the journal Science.
I open sourced it right away. Because it's easy to do, you'll have the entire community across the world begin working on this.
MIT has already heard from solar firms interested in licensing the technology. Solar energy is the hottest of the green technologies, which include biofuels and wind power. But right now, solar accounts for less than 1% of energy use in the U.S. Monique Hannes is with the Solar Energy Industries Association.
We have companies all over the country and labs that are working to bring down the cost of solar all along the supply chain.
More than $500 million in venture capital poured into solar technology last year. An investment is on its way to another record in 2008. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
The higher oil prices go, of course, the more creative engineers get about getting it out of the ground. Deep-sea oil rigs today can withstand as much as 40,000 feet of water pressure. That's deeper than the oceans actually go, by the way. But hard-to-reach reserves exist on land as well. There's oil to be had in the sands of Alberta, Canada, and in the Rocky Mountains of the American West. Janet Babin reports from the Marketplace Innovations Desk on the latest energy source that's getting some attention.
It may be the largest untapped source of oil in the world, located in Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming. Interior Secretary Dirk Kempthorne described its potential.
This area is estimated to contain as much as 800 billion barrels of oil, 72% of which is located on federal lands.
That's enough to meet current U.S. oil demand for 110 years. But this oil is trapped inside oil shale, a brownish rock, fossilized algae, really. Adam Brandt studies oil shale at the University of California at Berkeley.
From looking at it, you wouldn't know that it was anything other than just a rock.
There is one easy way to tell oil shale from regular rock. Put a lit match to it.
It will burn in power plants in some places, like Estonia. They burn it in place of coal.
But extracting the oil from the rock takes a lot more than just lighting a match. It's energy intensive and costly. You have to bake a ton of rock to squeeze out just one barrel of oil. John Riley at MIT says the method also releases a lot of carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas.
A lot of energy is used in the processing, so the CO2 emissions are about twice that of oil. So it's much dirtier even than coal.
But with oil prices spiking over $100 a barrel, at least five companies are researching cleaner and more efficient oil shale extractions. Chevron has the most experimental approach. The company's shale manager, Robert Letts, says his team uses chemicals to extract the oil. It injects a fluid, a liquid form of CO2, into the rock.
The fluids that we're looking at using is the same type of fluid that's now being used to remove caffeine from coffee.
Letts says commercialization is at least 10 years out. Shell Oil's been conducting shale research for more than two decades and has already spent millions. It slow heats the rock for months to get at the oil. It freezes surrounding rock to protect groundwater from nasty residue. Brandt at UC Berkeley says the process shows promise.
I've run the calculations on it. It seems like from an energetic perspective, it's going to work. You get more energy out of the shale than you put into it.
Brandt also raises concerns about water contamination. But analysts think over time, technology will solve these problems. And any oil shale developments on public lands would have to be vetted by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
We've done solar so far today and oil shale. Someday in the future, they might help substantially offset the cost of regular oil, down more than $2.50 today to about $124 a barrel, just so you know. But for the moment, most of us are dependent on crude in some way, shape, or form, whether it's to power our cars or, in some parts of the country, to heat our homes. More than 80% of the home heating oil used in the United States goes to the Northeast. In Vermont, the vast majority of people use oil or kerosene to stay warm when it's cold outside. And this year, they're worried they're not going to be able to afford it. From Vermont Public Radio, Jane Lindholm reports.
It's hurricane season in the south, and the first storm to make landfall, Dolly, didn't do too much damage. But in the northeast, Vermonters have their eyes fixed on the weather headed their way, and they think there could be a lot of damage.
This is our Category 5 storm, except we have 6 months to prepare, and shame on us if we don't.
Matt Cota is the executive director of the Vermont Fuel Dealers Association, and the storm he's talking about is this winter's heating season. Rates for fuel oil have doubled in just 2 years, and consumers are struggling to come up with enough money to get them through the winter at $5 a gallon prices. The government assistance that helps the poorest Vermonters pay for heat won't come close to covering the costs this year, and even people who consider themselves middle class are worried. Retiree Richard Izor is one of them.
I've always had like a $200 a month buffer in my budget, so that's what I'm going to have to use to pay for my fuel. And it's not going to cover it either. I'll be short about $75 a month.
It's not just consumers, though, who are struggling. Vermont fuel dealers are mostly mom-and-pop operations, and they're often willing to let good customers slide for a few weeks. But Matt Cota at the Fuel Dealers Association says this year dealers just don't have that flexibility. Many need triple the line of credit at their banks just to cover the same amount of fuel as last year.
Many dealers are having to put their personal property, their cars, their homes, up as collateral. So when you're dealing with those massive numbers, Yeah, you bet you're going to be careful. You're not going to purchase all of your oil and just hope that people show up with a check in hand.
Peter Born runs Born's Energy in Morrisville. His father started the business in 1948, and he's on a first-name basis with many of his customers. Born thinks he'll be okay. He has a good relationship both with his suppliers and with his bank. But he fears that many small dealers in the region will either drop out or go out of business this winter.
I think a fear I have is that if the state of Vermont ends up with very few family businesses running the energy business, who's looking out for the customers?
That's what Richard Izor wants to know, too. He says it keeps him up at night, worrying. He wants government action.
I'd like to see him come in and put a ceiling on the oil price now, before it gets any bigger. Why they haven't done this is more than I can understand.
Fuel dealer Peter Born is hoping this is just a speculative bubble and that the price will drop, maybe to $3.50, $4. Still high, but more manageable. But right now, he just feels terrible. He got a call the other day.
A 74-year-old lady has been a customer for 16 years and asking, is there anything you can do? And I'm saying, I can't do a thing. That's the worst, because I know people are going to be hurting, and there's not a damn thing I can do about it.
In Vermont, I'm Jane Lindholm for Marketplace.
Coming up, real-life lessons from fiction.
It's about human connection through storytelling, through moments that'll stop you and give you pause.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials plunged 1.75% today, 205 points to finish at 11,378. The NASDAQ inched down 0.1%, 4 points, closed at 2325. The S&P 500 stumbled 1.33%, 16 points, ended the day at 1267. Bristol-Myers Squibb offered $60 a share for the biotech company ImClone Systems. ImClone shareholders think Bristol will do better. Shares of ImClone shot up 37% to about $64. Bristol-Myers Squibb declined 1.8% today. The two companies co-market the cancer drug Erbitux. Not a picture-perfect day for Eastman Kodak. The photography giant snapped down 0.7% after profits did not meet expectations. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.95%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for the month of July. The Commerce Department releases the June report on construction spending. And the three-day music fest, Lollapalooza, opens in Chicago's Grant Park. The long list of entertainment includes Radiohead, Love and Rockets, and Nine Inch Nails. Have fun. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. If lower gas prices help send more of you to the beach this summer, we've got some books you might want to take along. Our summer series, Marketplace Beach Reads, is back this week with recommendations from some of our commentators. Today, we take you to the world of Arab storytelling. Mona El-Tahawi says it's a place where tradition and modern life blend in unusual ways.
Allow me to be your god, writes Rabia Halimuddin in the Hakawati. Let me take you on a journey beyond imagining. Let me tell you a story. And what a fabulous story it is. Dozens of stories, in fact, like Middle Eastern babushka dolls, each story in the Hakawati contains another within it. Here are characters who love, do business and suffer, centuries ago and in the modern Middle East. In the modern age, there's Osama al-Khadrat. He's a Lebanese tech who returns home to Beirut from L.A. to stand vigil at his father's deathbed. Usama's grandfather is the Hakawati, or storyteller, of the title. He made a living out of spinning yarns. The Hakawati was a primary form of entertainment in the Arab world for centuries. He'd captivate audiences in coffee shops and the courts of the rich and famous with tales that often took weeks to tell. Radio eventually killed the Hakawati, and now in place of his stories, are television channels from across the globe beamed into those same coffee shops via satellite. Ana Medin brings the Hakawati back to life by telling his grandfather's tales, but ultimately by being our Hakawati, who captivates us with rich prose, weaving the ancient into the modern, the local with the global. From his grandfather, Usama learns that we tell stories to soothe troubled hearts and to make sense of pain, and also the importance of that ultimate of modern business techniques, networking. His grandfather cultivated contacts as an apprentice in the pigeon business. They loan Usama's family money to help them open Beirut's first car dealership under the family name Al-Kharrat, which means Fipster. The Lebanese lacked a sense of irony, says Usama, in just one of the novel's many delicious instances of humor. No one thought it strange that a car dealership and the family that ran it had a name that meant teller of tall tales. Ana Medin tells his stories to keep alive an Arab world very few in this country see, one full of humor, music, romance, and boisterous family ties. The Hakawati is testament to the healing power of stories, but even more importantly, their ability to humanize.
Mona El-Tahawi is a syndicated columnist. She lives in New York City. Listener Gary Pearson of Cedar Park, Tennessee, recommended this to us. Manias, Panics, and Crashes, A History of Financial Crises by Charles Kindleberger. Nothing in there on subprime, sad to say, but you will learn about the great tulip bubble of 1636. If you've got a title to share with us, go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says Marketplace Beach Reads. I think if you took a general survey, most of the, quote, business books out there would be shelved in the nonfiction section. But former Harvard professor and author Robert Coles took fiction to the Harvard Business School. For many years, he taught MBA students using qualitative, not quantitative, lessons about business by having them read people like Raymond Carver and Flannery O'Connor. He's put some of those stories together in an anthology called Minding the Store. And when I asked him why, he told me a story about his own mentor, the poet and physician William Carlos Williams.
He once turned to me and he said, you know, a lot going on in this world outside of those college gates. People are trying to make a living, and some of them are hiring them, and some of them are firing them. That's the way he used to talk. And he got me thinking about writers and their connection to society and the way they evoke what goes on in the world. And that's basically what I did at Harvard Business School.
How did you pick these stories?
I picked them from my teaching life and reading life. I picked them because in one way or the other, businessmen appear. The business world is approached. And in a vernacular sense, these folks are either running stores or getting people to come into their stores. And by the way, there's a story in this book called The Housebreaker of Shady Hill. What a story. It's a story of upper-class life, but there's a guy there who's a little hard up, and what does he do? He takes his neighbor's wallet and takes some dough. And it goes into the inner life of desire, covetousness, yearning.
And that's the lesson, right? Not that stealing's wrong, although it is. It's that you have to think about what you do. Could I get you to read part of this for me, Dr. Coles? The bit where Cheever has his character in this story, Johnny Hake, talking about how, despite all his problems, life really is pretty good.
Okay. He says, I served 4 years in the Navy, have 4 kids now, and I live in a banlieue, note the French, called Shady Hill. We have a nice house with a garden and a place outside for cooking meat. And on summer nights, sitting there with the kids and looking into the front of Christina's dress as she bends over to salt the steaks, or just gazing at the lights in heaven, I am as thrilled as I am thrilled by more hardy and dangerous pursuits. And I guess this is what is meant by the pain and sweetness of life.
When you taught this course, were you trying to change the way people do business or the way people think about business?
I'll tell you what we're trying to do is change people in the sense to get them to stop, look, and listen. Just to think about life and its meaning. That's what this book is about. It's about human connection through storytelling, through moments that'll stop you and give you pause about what life means, which is what great stories do and which I think business people all the time are trying to do because, you know, in their own way, they're offering themselves and what they have to offer to other people and trying to bring them in sort of to their living room. Come here. Be with me. Take what I have to offer. Join this world. For a few seconds, we are a world. We're together. And as I repeat from Forster, we've connected.
Robert Coles is an educator. He's a child psychiatrist. He is a writer. And he is with Albert Lafarge, the editor of the new book, Minding the Store. Great writing about business from Tolstoy to now. Dr. Coles, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me here.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, it's about fear and self-loathing in the marketing business. Professors at Villanova University gathered a group of college-aged women together and showed them ads featuring thin models. Then, as thanks for participating, the women were offered a pack of Oreo cookies. The overwhelming majority of them said no to the cookies, but they did say they would buy the brands and products that the ads had featured. One researcher said the analysis goes something like this, that thin models make women feel bad about themselves, but they like it, and that ads using normal size models didn't affect women's body image, but they didn't like the brands and products that those ads featured either. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 205 points, 1.75%. The NASDAQ lost 4 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 fell 16 points. That's 1.33%. Kevin Arnovitz, Stephen Gregory, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, John Haas, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, MTV culture clashes with tribal traditions.
The East Coast and the West Coast really having this hip-hop dancing, and they're doing dirty dancing, you know, with grass dance and stuff, and, you know, people were really upset on the reservation.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.